Today's guest asks, why do perfectly well-meaning people sit around discussing how to solve the problem of urban food deserts when they could be out planting food in those very same food deserts? Everyone, everywhere. Give a listen to Mark Shepherd, author of Restoration Agriculture, and add some of his wisdom to your bag of gardening tricks. I'm Robin Clare. Stay tuned for part two. This is Tributaries.
And so I immediately decided, well, what we're going to do is we're going to get a calf, we'll raise our own calf, take responsibility for it, and then we'll actually get to the point where we butcher an animal that we raised ourselves. Oh, my goodness. So we bought a dairy bull calf, which at the time were a dime a dozen, and we raised it on grass, almost exclusively on grass. And then in the fall, I actually shot it and butchered it on site, and we put it in the freezer. Well, you know, winter goes on and spring rolls around, the snow melts and the grass starts to green up, and I look at the green grass and say, you know, it's time to get another bull calf. Then I went down to the house and looked in the freezer, and it was still full of beef because we hadn't been eating beef. So we counted how many packages of beef we had to eat before next fall in order to get rid of it, and we figured out that we had to have beef at least one meal a day in order to utilize all this beef that we grew last year. And so we started to put it in all of our different recipes. And do you know what we discovered? We discovered that beef makes a remarkable substitute for tofu. Any dish that you would use tofu in, try beef instead. It carries the flavor. It's a complete protein. And we had to laugh at ourselves because we did the tofu thing backwards.
Right. A lot of us are in with that story.
Yeah. 20 years later, there's this book, Restoration Agriculture, which, you know, basically chronicles my experiences doing my best to apply the principles of ecology and restoring ecosystems to a worn-out, run-down 100-acre piece of property in southwest Wisconsin. And the results have been wonderful, hardworking, of course, family life in rural America, you know, raising two wonderful kids and transforming a piece of property into what could arguably called, you know, a Garden of Eden.
Yes, it certainly looks like it. There are beautiful pictures in your book, Restoration Agriculture. As I mentioned, it's kind of funny to be on the opposite end of the question, but before we get too far along, let's talk about, you know, that 40 to 60% of grain that we need to give to our animals and our livestock. And how can raising chestnut trees and pecan trees even compare?
Well, we don't need to give 40% of our annual grains, our human food. We don't have to give our human food to animals because one of the wonders of animal agriculture and the reason why humans and animals went into association with one another is humans eat different foods than animals do. If you look at like this, a National Geographic movie of the Serengeti savanna in Africa in your mind, you'll see, you know, people and lions and wildebeest and gemsbok and ibex and all zebras and all these different creatures. Well, everybody's eating a different, slightly different thing. And in the human cultures, we can eat things off of trees. We can eat grains. Yes, we can if we cook them. But like cattle, for example, they eat grasses and broad-leaved plants that we can't digest. They are designed to digest cellulose. And pigs are designed to eat all kinds of things from cosmetically inferior food plants to dead animals. They just love to hunt out and root out snakes, which is unfortunate because I like to have snakes to eat the mice that like to nibble the bark off my apple trees. But now we're playing the ecology game instead of playing the how much corn can we get on 1 acre game. So I think I successfully avoided answering your question, but I didn't mean to.
Well, then let's get down to business here.
So back to how does, let's say I want to grow pecans. If you want to grow pecans, I want my pecan tree to grow faster so I can actually get yields in my lifetime. I want it to have higher yields, more nutritious yields. So that means I want it to have adequate water and adequate soil fertility. so wouldn't it serve the tree quite well if I had a cow out there eating the grass that I can't digest and then pooping and peeing next to the tree, which goes into the soil and fertilizes the tree and waters the tree. So what I've done is I've accomplished work without actually having to spend any money. As a matter of fact, instead of spending money on a tractor and a mower and fertilizer and herbicide to take care of the weeds, I actually get a economic yield out of it. You totally turn the economic equation, you would totally reverse it. Anytime you see an expense in agriculture, and this is some of the most creative and strangest fun that I have, is anytime you hear the word problem or I hear the word expense, it's like, all right, well, how can I make money off this?
I love your undaunted attitude about everything, and it certainly is all through your book. For instance, talking about tools, because if you do this restoration agriculture, there are new ways that things need to be harvested, and you can't just run through one field of one monocrop and get it all picked up. Have you come up with designs for different machinery?
Well, what's interesting about it is all of the crops that we would use in a system, no matter where you live in the USA, there are certain numbers of plants and animals that will just grow there naturally all by themselves with no care, and you see them growing in the ditches on the side of the road all the time, no matter where you live. Every single edible and useful plant that you see growing in the ditches on the side of the road somewhere is an industry worldwide. There are 7 billion people on this planet. There is no such thing as a niche market. If you look at a niche market and all you see is the niche, you're looking at the wrong place. Everything is a huge, huge mass market, and the machinery exists for 99.999% of it be all mechanized. And a lot of people have objections to mechanized agriculture at all. And what I would recommend for those people who have objections to mechanized agriculture is to stop eating right now, unless your food came from something that somebody harvested by hand. And you'll go hungry in a real hurry, because this whole world, in order to get the sheer total number of calories harvested for people that we need, processed, transported, and then distributed, it needs to be done on a large scale, and it needs to be mechanized somehow. And so most of the machinery exists. And where the machinery doesn't exist, like in our case, there hasn't been any machinery for the bush hazelnut industry, because most of hazelnuts have been grown on European hazels, either over in Europe, South America, or in the Pacific Northwest. And they're intentionally grown as small trees, even though they are large shrubs. So what we're doing here is we're inventing the equipment that will deal with a hazelnut bush as a hazelnut bush, instead of forcing the hazelnut bush to act like a tree. Because trying to force nature to act like our idea of what nature should be, it's an expense. We would rather go ahead and deal with nature as it is in the low-cost, no-expense method. And that might mean new equipment and machinery. And one of the things that I ended up inventing was a hazelnut cracker. It's actually patented now. That'll crack any size nut without size separation. Any kind of nut, you just throw them all in there together. Don't have to mix them all out. You can sort the kernels out later. All of the sorting and separating technology is off-the-shelf, mass-produced technology.
That's wonderful. And it would seem that the bush would actually be much more prolific than the tree.
Per square foot of ground that it takes up, it actually is. But when somebody goes out and they plant a bush and they find out that they only get like 2 pounds of nuts off a bush, they're like, what the heck? I'm not getting any yields off of this. It's like, well, what we are talking about also here is scale, agricultural scale, not the nibble snacks scale. And if we're going to compare corn and beans, which are annual staple food crops, to chestnuts and hazelnuts, which are perennial staple food crops, we're not talking about 3 chestnut trees in your backyard or a couple hazelnut bushes. 3 chestnut trees might get you 30 pounds of chestnuts and you get 6 or 8 pounds of hazelnuts. That won't feed you. You need acres and acres and acres and acres of staple food crops to feed you. And on an acres by acres basis, yes, the bushes are right in the ballpark with the large trees as far as yields per acre is concerned. And I'm gonna kind of soft pedal a little bit there, because there actually is live research being done right now on yields of, like, for example, Midwestern bush hazels to, you know, European miniature tree hazels. And most woody crops, apples are a prime example. What's being discovered is that when you plant the trees much too close together compared to what people did, you know, 20, 30, 100 years ago, you get more yield in the early years. You'll get less yield per plant, but more total yield per acre. And when if I'm a farmer, that's what I want, is more total yield per acre. So to plant more hazelnut bushes per acre and get less hazelnuts per plant is a trade-off that works.
We're speaking, I'm assuming, to mostly urban livers, but most people are not your large farmers with a lot of acreage. What do you suggest to the person that has a backyard?
Well, whoever it is, wherever they live, whether they're going to do it at the backyard scale, homestead scale, or farm or ranch scale, is to, first of all, take some time and observe the plants, the trees and shrubs and bushes and vines that naturally grow around you, especially the ones that are growing with no care, and even more so, especially the ones that are growing, like, on the ditches on the side of the road that the town or the county, whatever, goes by every once in a while and chips off to get rid of, and they keep coming back. Because if you have plants in your area that the road crew can't get rid of, and they can abuse it for year after year after year, that's sustainable agriculture. So then imitate what nature is doing and plant this tree over that shrub, next to this shrub, next to those vines and canes and so on. And everywhere you live, no matter where you live, there are those family of plants that will live in association with one another. And the most widespread family of plants in North America is the family of plants that fits into the oak savanna biome. And it would be the Fagaceae, which is oak, chestnut, or beech, hazelnut, the Prunus family, which includes tall specimens, medium specimens, and shrub specimens, and those are the cherries, peaches, plums, almonds. Then there are, I already mentioned hazelnut, yes, apples, the Malus family. Then there are raspberries and blackberries. Then there are grapes that climb on the whole system in the sun, and there are gooseberries and currants that live in the shade. Now, in Colorado, because you're currently right in Boulder right now, right?
That's correct.
What I recommend you do is all go down to Boulder Creek and start walking up Boulder Creek, put your waders on, and start walking upstream and identify the shrubs on the side of the road. And you can walk all the way up Boulder Creek, and you will see exactly those species that I just mentioned to you.
You suggested we all observe that our county crews are going out alongside of the roads and destroying year after year after year. And you say, yes, that's sustainable agriculture. But what does that have to do with eating? I mean, I can bring a goat out to eat that thistle, but I'm not planning on that.
Well, and that, those aren't the only plants that are getting mowed down. You know, they claim, like, there's just one patch of road next to me that I've actually been taking photographs of it over the past 20 years now, how many times they kill it. And it was literally, a hickory, oak, hazelnut, wild plum, raspberry, apple, and grape. And they mow this thing every single year, and all those plants keep coming back. They keep coming back. They keep coming back. They can't kill it. And so if you got all this brush growing up on the side of the road and they can't kill it, those are the plants. And those are the plant behaviors that we want for our food plants. And if you can plant a system, and my farm is a case in point, they can mow my farm down every single year from now until eternity, and it's going to come back with all these food plants that are highly productive, pest and disease resistant, you know, all of that. Another thing was like thistle. Anytime you have something that's a problem, I'll put the word problem in quotes, that actually is a profit that we haven't figured out how to exploit yet.
Perfect.
So I've sold thistle flowers at $13 a bushel to medicinal herb companies. A lot of people say, oh, but that's not agriculture. Medicinal herbs are like a niche market. Well, go to that big blue box down the road and go to the pill section and look at all the different weeds that are for sale on their medicinal herb shelf. Medicinal herbs is big, big, big business. And
yes,
what you will find is if you go out and you try to act like a niche grower and grow a few of this and a few of that, is you won't have enough to satisfy the buyers. We're talking, we need farms, large farm-scale perennial polyculture agriculture.
Yes.
Actually, that reminded me a little bit about marketing that I'd like to touch on. It ties back to yields and total site yields. Our situation in that we have a number of different crops. My best, I only have like seven or eight different crops growing in the same place. Well, because of that, each individual crop is yielding less than if it was an orchard of that particular crop. And I use the chestnuts as one example. Well, since I'm growing fewer apples than an apple orchard would, fewer apples per acre, it may not be very economical for me to sell those apples. I don't have enough to pay my bills. Maybe too small for me to access real markets. So what I have to do is I have to collaborate with my neighbors who are doing similar things, and we pool our product together. Or somebody starts a new company, or we start a cooperative or a collaborative that aggregates the product that's distributed across these many farms, puts it into the form and into the volume that's needed to access markets, then away it goes. One of the collaborations that I'm a part of, I was not one of the founding members, but I was a real early member in the Organic Valley Cooperative here in Wisconsin, and they aggregate and distribute everything from produce to milk and eggs and citrus juices and soy products. I'm also a part of the American Hazelnut Company, which is a fledgling hazelnut growers collaborative, Tree Crops Incorporated, which is a number of different edible woody crops, and right now the Savannah Commons Project, which is it's like a CSA buying club that purchases various different products from restoration agriculture modeled farms. And so we'll just need to have different ways to access the market. And that might mean, oh no, collaborating with your neighbors.
Colorado is quite arid, and trees don't grow here like they do in southwest Wisconsin. We don't need to go into the temperature necessarily, but at what point is it too dry? What trees will do well without a lot of water?
Part of the situation with more arid climates, any animal population, their numbers are limited by certain environmental factors, and water is a limiting factor. So in more arid areas, any individual, you know, type of animal will have a larger range. So in Colorado, for, you know, each individual human being, you just need more space for one, because everything is going to grow more slowly. But with some very simple land shaping and water management, every drop of water that falls on the ground can be slowed down, spread out from the valleys to the ridges, and soaked into the soil. There are places that I know of where they're growing edible wood crops on less than 5 inches of annual rainfall per year. And that's entirely possible with land shaping and water management, you know, mulching, microclimate enhancement. And then the species selection, you know, you would obviously not choose very water-hungry plants. You wouldn't use very water-hungry pecan or black walnut in the drier parts of Colorado. You would stick with things like your gamble oaks, your pinon pine, and, yes, hazelnut. And one of the reasons why I suggested you take a stroll up Boulder Creek is the fact that the entire family of species that I mentioned, the Oak Savanna family species, I've gone all the way up Boulder Creek. I forget what's the town where it basically originates in. And there are oaks, wild crab apple, hazelnuts, wild plum, raspberries, all the way up Boulder Creek. So that family species works there. And then, of course, you can switch over into your pine with your pinon and also get hazelnuts growing in there. You can also get apples growing in there. So just look at the plants that are around you. Imitate that. Manage the water resource and farm it forever.
Well, Mark, I know you travel literally around the world, and when I first tried to set something up with you, you were in Tanzania?
Tanzania.
Tell us something about your travels. What is the most amazing surprise you've encountered, or what are you asked about mostly?
Let's see. The most amazing thing that I encountered was when a 14-foot-long python broke into the chicken coop in Tanzania and caused quite a big stir. I don't know if you've ever seen a 14-foot-long python.
Not in person.
And how fast they can strike. And, yeah, it was a pretty amazing experience. So that was probably the most amazing. And the other one was waking up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom and find that I'm standing in the middle of a herd of Cape buffalo. And they're notorious as the most deadly animals out there, that you can never kill them, and if they want to stomp you, they will. But let's see, the most common question I get, it's not a question so much as a disbelief, and that people just don't believe that you can get food from perennial plants. Is for, you know, so many of us around the world, we are so ingrained into thinking that food means, you know, rice and beans and wheat and corn and bread and pasta. It's like, well, you know, we don't need to grow annual plants in order to grow those starches and carbohydrates and proteins and oils. We can use perennial plants, and people just don't believe it. And so you've got to set it up and prove it to them, and then all of a sudden they realize how easy it is. And especially in the tropics, when things take off so fast, the smiles on people when they're like, wow, you know, the work that I don't have to do now, this is great. I planted this plantain last August. It's 12 feet tall now. It's crazy. It's gonna have, you know, huge bundles of fruit on it by this summer. It's crazy.
And where?
That one's in Tanzania.
Oh, okay. I was going to say that can't be on Nufar's farm.
No. Yes. Well, but that, you know, some of the things that can be on New Forest Farm, if you look around the world, let's just pick two of my favorite, coffee and cocoa. There are coffee plants and there are cocoa plants that live high in the mountains. And high in the mountains, you get very, very cold. The genetics for cold, hardy cocoa and coffee exist on this planet. The only reason why we don't have coffee and cocoa grown in Iowa is because nobody's bothered to go looking for the genetics. Mm-hmm. Part of the industrial system has been to find the genetic variants, the types that actually survive in the broadest range of climates, not the genetics that are suited for a more specific climate. So if we want to look for a specific climate that gets down to 50 below zero in the wintertime and 116 in the summertime, which happens here in southwest Wisconsin, I can go to specific parts of the Andes and go right up to those spots and go looking for the genetics for cocoa and coffee, bring them up here, and they'll survive. There's no reason in the world, other than the fact that we haven't bothered to go looking for them and plant those plants. So those of you who travel around the world, I recommend that you become a plant experimenter.
It's great just to get more variety among the different kinds of plants. Certainly, it's everything is becoming monocultured.
And I think both actually, believe it or not, have their place. Let's use a totally unrelated analogy. Let's take like the craftsman who makes the most incredible soap in the world. Soap is something that every little village, every little town, or wine, or, you know, whatever little craft product, there are things that are so specific to to particular regions that are worth doing as a craft product. They bring a higher price. There's a more, you know, the quality that it has is more important. But then there's something like tires. You know, tires on your car, you want durability, good traction in the snow, the wet, the ice, whatever it is, off-road. Well, are you about to set up a craftsman tire building company and have tires made in every little village? What's the difference between the tires I make and the tires you make three towns over? It doesn't matter. We're after, like, the same kind of thing. So there is a need for, like, industrially produced stuff. But then there is an absolute need for the craft local terroir of, you know, my valley versus your valley, you know, my varieties versus your varieties. It's not a versus. It's mine and yours. It's a new abundance that we can create with this diversity.
Mark, what's the favorite thing about your farm to you?
My favorite thing? All right, this is not intended to offend at all, but it's just to be a little bit provocative. Sustainable agriculture. If you have to plant your crops again next year, I don't think that's very sustainable at all. The 35th oldest organism on the face of the planet is a chestnut tree. It's about 4,200 years old. So it's
how do you know chestnut. That?
I'm a chestnut aficionado. It's growing on the eastern flank of Mount Etna in Sicily. And one of the reasons why I know that, you set me up. It's like my 13th great-grandmother is part of a story that I don't know if I have enough time to tell it on the radio. she was in love with her dad, you know, whatever this minor royalty. She was in love with her dad's number one soldier guy. Well, dad had to set up a political relationship with this guy in the principality up next door, and so he promised his daughter to this old geezer up the road. So the old geezer takes her away, and they get married. It's not known whether they consummated the marriage or not. So she sends a text message to dad's number one guy. He says, oh, number one, I love you so much. Come rescue me, please. So he comes with 100 horsemen. They rescue her. It was a total surprise. They all hop on horses, and they ride away. Well, then a big thunderstorm comes up, and so they all take shelter, 100 horses, underneath this one chestnut tree in the eastern flank of Mount Etna in Sicily. And that tree, to this day, holds the record for the largest diameter trunk ever of any tree on planet Earth. So here's a chestnut tree that produces a corn equivalent, it's nutritionally equivalent to corn. It's been doing so without pesticides, herbicides, fungicides, fertilizers, plows, people taking care of it hardly at all for the last 4,980 years it's been producing a crop. That's sustainable agriculture.
Yes, and did they do it with the appropriate amount of space in between? You had mentioned earlier that they can be planted more closely than what we've been known to do as of late.
No, these were Roman legion soldiers who had an idea of the way things should be in the world, and they told the local residents what to do or else they'd put them to death. So.
Right. And on that note...
Not much different than today, you know.
I wanted to thank Acres Magazine. They not only published books like yours, but they were very generous in supporting KGNU during our fundraiser with some copies of your book that people were able to get as premiums. And what do you have to say about Acres?
One of the things I like about Acres USA is that they also seem to be at the edge of the cutting edge. Like if you strike a match, there's like this leading edge of a flame. It's not really a flame. It's not the big part. It's not where the heat is. It's not where all the action is. But it's at that edge that's going out where no one else has gone before. And Acres is not afraid to go there. And I really appreciate that about it. Another thing that I really like about Acres is that Acres, a thorough understanding anyways, of the fact that the environment, our food, our nutrition, and agriculture are one in the same thing. There's not separate topics at all. And that all of those things directly relate to our interpersonal relationships and even, might I say, spirituality of being human. They are part of our values. And they're not afraid to talk about any about that. I really like that about Acres.
Yes, and I love how they really say what the pulse of the whole economy is going to be from being ensconced in the farm and the farmers.
And one of the things about that, too, is also not looking at the world from the way that the rest of the world looks at it, which is pretty unique for magazines in this world. Acres USA is looking at it from a big, long, broad historical context. That's one of the reasons why I went with them as publishers, is because they could understand that issues of soil erosion in Iowa have everything to do with Mesopotamia 10,000 years ago. There's a direct link. To them, that wasn't a mystery.
Many thanks to Mark Shepherd, author of Restoration Agriculture, on his way to plant some more trees. And also, check out Acres USA. Wonderful folks, publisher of fine books, and very, very wise information in their monthly periodical. For any guest information, to listen to archives, share resources, and sign up for weekly programming, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. iTunes podcasting at Tributaries Radio. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.